What the Health with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Good morning and welcome to FUBAR Radio. What the Health with me, Georges Bertineau. I'm an online health and fitness expert. I have a BSc in sports rehabilitation and I'm a former head of medical and performance in professional football. I've been a fitness and health expert for over a decade and I've been helping real people feel better and move smarter. If you are sick of dodgy health advice online, you're in the right place because every week I help you cut through the chaos, confusion of the internet and nonsense, bringing clarity, evidence and a whole lot of energy. I'll be joined by expert guests as we dissect trends, bust myths and guide you towards real lasting results the healthy way. I'm going to be joined by Megan Jane Crabb, author and body positivity activist. But up first, we are joined by Thomas, who is the founder of The Breath Coach. Thomas, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. How's your morning been?
Really good. I just got back from a swim, so I can't complain.
Amazing. So, Thomas, before we start, you are a BSc in sport and exercise science. You're an advanced oxygen advantage instructor and is an ADA 1 and 2 free diver.
That's right.
Amazing. Okay. So tell us a little bit more about breath coaching. What exactly is it and how does it differ simply from just maybe taking a deep breath?
Well, yeah, breath coaching is about helping people understand how they breathe and how it affects their body and the mind, like their mental, their physical, and their emotional response to stress, anxiety, and also like performance. So it's not as simple as taking a deep breath. There's a lot more to it than that. And now we know we're drowned in science around it. And everything is pointing towards if we can manage our breathing and increase our awareness of our breath, our breathing mechanics, and also our CO2 tolerance, then it puts us in a really good place.
Okay. So you've worked with everyone from CEOs to elite athletes. What draws such a wide range of people to breath work?
Well, it's the one thing that we do as soon, you know, where we're born, we take our first breath. When we die, we take our last one. It's what we do in between that connects us all. We're all breathing and it's automatic. But once we can raise some awareness about how we're breathing and making each breath optimal, then things begin to fit into place. And everyone is the same, you know, that the people I coach from kids in schools, elite athletes, amateur athletes, through to CEOs, etc. Everyone is under a degree of stress now. And I think that's the important thing to recognize is that we can manage stress a lot better than we do in the UK and worldwide, but in the UK. And the quickest way for the body for the nervous system to adapt and to manage stress better is through the breath.
Okay. And obviously we mentioned CEOs and, you know, obviously CEOs are oftenly associated with the corporate world. You were involved in the corporate world yourself, correct?
Yes. What? Yes, in London.
Okay. Yeah. So busy life, lots of stress, you know, lots of commuting potentially. What moment or experience led you to realize the power of breath work?
It was finding, and it's really simple. It was, I've got a deviated septum. So when I was playing football as a 16-year-old, I took a nasty blow to the face and that caused my airway to be blocked in my right nostril. So at that point, what I didn't realize was that my breathing has switched from nasal breathing at night with my mouth closed to my mouth wide open. And then I developed some snoring. What happens then when you're not using it over that kind of like 8,000 breaths you're taking in the night is that you're constricting your upper lower airways. You're reducing blood flow and you're reducing oxygen delivery to working cells, muscles, etc. while you're asleep. So you wake up fatigued. You know, if you're breathing really heavily with your mouth open and sounding like a Like this, or you're snoring, that takes a lot of energy opposed to a silent breath in and out through the nose. So I started using some sleep tape on my mouth and quickly realized that my energy had increased a lot during that kind of week to 2 weeks. And then the sports scientist in me was looking back at what I've learned about breathing, and there was no mention of nasal over mouth at that time, back in like 2001. So I went deeper into it, listened to podcasts, you know, hired a coach, read loads of books, and figured that if I could increase my energy levels in the morning by just simply keeping my mouth closed, there was way more in this. And then the performance side came, and you know, and it kind of like it went on from there. And here we are now talking about breathwork, and a complete shift in my life and my lifestyle, where I live, everything.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because I'm seeing a lot at the moment on mouth tape. I have some, don't use it very often, but it's something I want to get into regularly. And also the nose thingies that they clip onto your nose. Have you seen much of that?
Yeah, like, people can see me here, but just simple mouth tape, which you take off.
Yeah.
Peel a little bit off and stick over the lips.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone. It's not like... it's low-lying fruit, you know, for everyone that can that can obtain this. But there are some different complications. Like, for instance, my deviated septum. What I didn't realize, I was taking it off about 2 o'clock every night in the middle of the night, and I didn't know why. And it was, what was going on was my deviated septum was reducing airflow, and then a little bit of congestion during the night, which is natural when you sleep, when you lay down, was blocking my airway, and then I was feeling suffocated. And I had a very low CO2 tolerance. So we can talk about that in a second, but that CO2 tolerance was making me feel suffocated along with the closed airway. So I use a nasal dilator, which sticks, you take the back off. It's very sticky. It's got a bit of plastic in the middle.
Okay.
And as you stick it on your nose, it opens up your nose and your nostrils to increase airflow.
Okay. Yeah, because I also heard, and you might be able to correct me with this, that mouth breathing changes the shape of your face as well. So that's why it's quite important to breathe through your nose. Is that something you've heard?
I would say that was very small amount if you're an adult. But if you're a kid and your kids are sleeping with their mouths open, then you have got a really good chance of changing the way they look. It's pretty crazy.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Keeping the tongue in the upper part of the mouth into the upper palate, just behind the front two teeth, keeping the mouth closed during the night. So if your kids are sleeping with their mouths open, that would be the first thing I would do. I would look at what their breathing is like. If they can keep some sleep tape on their mouth whilst they're awake during the day for a minute, and they can sleep 24, they can breathe nasally for 24 hours a day.
Okay.
But I would speak to a breathing specialist or your doctor before you go down that route.
You try anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
The face can change. The teeth are wider.
Yeah. That's what I heard.
The jaw is wider. Airways are bigger. So if you think about, I don't know if you're a football fan, George, but...
for my sins, a Saints fan, yeah.
If you look around, how many of the footballers you see have got a long face with their mouth constantly open? And I could probably name a couple.
Yeah.
But generally, all of the athletes are, you know, if you're looking at Olympians, footballers, rugby players, they have this big wide face, like a big smile, not a narrow face like mine. Their airways are wide and not compromised. So if your child wants to be competitive in sport or even become an elite athlete, I would suggest that they need to keep their mouth closed day and night.
In class as well as when they're sleeping.
In class, It helps with concentration too.
Yeah. Okay. So how does better breathing help people become calmer and more resilient in high-stress situations, whether that's at work or in sport?
Yeah, sure. You're looking at nervous system balance, and that's something that it's like a bit of a hip word at the moment, but balancing the nervous system is super, super important. There's a lot of people that are switched, like constantly switched on. They may feel like I did in my job back in London, like, you know, stressed, overwhelmed, burnt out, not able to focus, not present with their family.
Yeah.
And it's like a constant cycle. You're in this rat race in London, for instance, or a big city.
Never ends, yeah.
You're commuting. You might have a toxic boss like I did, and things might not be going too well. Mm. And then you develop some anxiety. You might start developing some IBS or some tingling in your fingers. Mm. Or you might feel that your breath shifts up into your chest and things are moving. You might hold your breath when an email comes in. Mm. Or 50 emails turn up in the morning when you put your computer on. And that's dysfunctional breathing. And it's just about bringing some awareness into your day from the time you wake up. How do you feel? Do a body check. And then bookend your day with some breath work. And it's very simple. I'm not asking you to do, I wouldn't ask a client to do, half an hour of breath work morning and night. It's a case of just knowing the client and trying to fit it in seamlessly into their day. And a lot of that comes around awareness. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I say it's interesting because I've been aware of times that I've done that. Like, I might be mid doing something and I might just hold my breath and I'm like, why am I holding my breath? So that's really
fascinating. Yeah, it's generally a stress response and it's your nervous system moving more into that fight or flight state rather than that parasympathetic state.
Yeah.
So we want more balance. It's the same with everything in life, right? You know, we need to exercise moderately, not overdo it because it's a stressor and our nervous system doesn't like that. Mm. But if we're stressed when we're at work, like I was, and then our go-to de-stressor is a stressor.
Okay.
You know,
yes.
Exercise. Then we feel more wired, and then we try to go to sleep, and our heart rate's up, cortisol's up, adrenaline's up, and we don't know how to downregulate. Then we have a poor night's sleep, and then we go into the next day and an even worse day, and it's this constant cycle.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle, and then like you said, with the rat race and everything, it's tough to get out of.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
yeah. It wasn't until that, you know, I had my first child living in Victoria Park in London, and I was traveling all the way to West London to Wembley Stadium.
Yeah,
did I realize how fried I was?
Yeah, just burnt out, absolutely cooked, yeah.
Cooked. And it was just that simple bit of awareness that my brother gave me, actually. We went on a walk when I was back in Yorkshire, and he said, you know, how are you doing? I said, I'm pretty done in, like, I'm not feeling good. I've got a lot of anxiety and stress, which I've never had before.
Yeah.
And a lot of symptoms relating to that.
Mm.
And he said, have you tried the sleep tape? And that was the catalyst to...
And that just helped you. Change. And then, amazing, okay. Yeah. So... for athletes, what specific benefits does breathe coaching unlock? You know, are we talking about endurance, recovery? Is it something deeper?
It's the whole lot. It's you know, how I would look at an athlete would be exactly the same as I would look at a client suffering from stress and anxiety, for instance. The athlete then would progress into, you know, reducing respiratory rate, improving their sleep and recovery,
yes,
which is super important between high intensity, especially for elite athletes who are really training super, you know, like five hours a day sometimes. Respiratory rate awareness, again, it's like it starts with awareness, then we move on to biomechanics. So we look at where the breath is coming in, nose over mouth, for instance, how deep their breath is going into their lungs, how efficient they are, how we can increase oxygen ventilation. And again, like that important part is the biochemistry of and pH of the blood, lactate threshold and CO2 tolerance. Yeah.
Okay. What are some of the most common breathing mistakes you see people make, especially in high pressure environments? Obviously you spoke shortly earlier about how some people might hold their breath when an email comes in and stuff like that. Is there potentially anything else, or is there a particular common one that you see or hear of?
Yeah, mouth breathing for definite.
Okay.
Mouth, generally, even if it's not like a big wide open, like
yeah,
big mouth, but it's just that okay, mouth being open. It's breath holding, like we said, upper chest breathing, and over breathing. So, you know, taking these big breaths or increased respiratory rate. We're full of oxygen. Our body is full of it. It's teeming with oxygen. It's when stress kicks in, our breathing rate increases and we begin to overbreathe. And that's super important to note, because when we begin to overbreathe, we tend to blow off lots of carbon dioxide. This carbon dioxide, which we see as CO2, which we see as a waste gas. The CO2 is the catalyst to release oxygen and open up, increased blood flow. So if we're overbreathing, what we're doing is we're actually not allowing the oxygen to leave the protein, oxygen-carrying protein hemoglobin. It's not released from the hemoglobin. It's not getting to the cells. It's not getting to the organs and the brain. So if we begin to hyperventilate, we're actually reducing oxygen delivery by up to 50%.
Wow, okay.
And hyperventilation can look super subtle. It can be, the mouth could be closed, but our breathing rate could be as high as 30. Like some people I see are respiratory rates, the number of breaths that we take in a minute.
Yeah.
Up at 30 breaths per minute.
That's a lot.
And that's a lot.
Yeah, wow.
At rest.
Yeah.
At rest.
Jeez.
And then I see, like, I've worked recently with an elite athlete whose respiratory rate at rest on the first bit of, you know, the consultation we took was 27.
That's high.
And this is someone who's elite.
Elite, like, yeah.
Elite.
And we're talking elite is, you know, elite.
Yeah. And it's a lot of training, and it's like, it's impressive. When you meet the elite athletes, you're like, oh, wow, this is like next level, you know? But she had a respiratory rate of 27. So we took that and we breathed with intention and got her down to around 6 to 10 breaths per minute when she's breathing with intention.
Oh, wow.
But slowly the brain begins to recognize that change. But when we do change so dramatically, we need to improve on the other side, our biochemistry and our CO2 tolerance. Mm. And those two together with the breathing mechanics and awareness, you know, she's now finishing like, you know, PBs. She's no longer getting stitches, which she was getting, which was stopping her performing races on transition.
Okay.
She's more efficient. And yeah, she's going for the podium at the moment. So yeah, in 6 months, dramatic changes just from it's very simple stuff, you know.
But yeah, but if you're unaware of it, how are you meant to? You know, there's so much information out there. I always say this to people: there's so much information out there. It's like, where do you start? So that's why having a coach is super important in my eyes, and it helps guide you. And sometimes 6 months can be life changing. 9, 12 months can really, really be a lot. And it kind of leads me on to my next question. What does a typical breath coaching session involve with you? You know, is it active? Is it educational? Is it a bit of everything?
Sure. It depends who the client is, George. It's kind of like, as you know, as a coach, it's about taking everything into account and looking at what someone's goals are, what their health is like, their age, their sex, and, you know, hormones play a part for women, for instance, with breathing. You take all of that into consideration. That they fill out a super detailed form, which gives me a really good idea of, say, everything from their sleep to their awareness of breath, what their goals are, what their performance goals are, if that's what they're looking at as an athlete, what their sleep's like, what they do to recover. And then we look at, you know, stress and decision making and all sorts of different parts of it. Then we have a consultation. We make sure that they're a right fit for me, you know, and the other way around, of course. And then we start on a tailored breathwork program. Mm. And it could be anything, like you say, from 4 weeks, 6, 10, 12, 6 months, some clients over a year. And the reason I'm a coach, not just a sleep tech, but it's how dramatic it made me feel as a person. You know, it's kind of
believe in it.
Yeah, all those symptoms I explained, you know, I talked about when I was super stressed.
Yeah,
it's completely disappeared. And one thing that the clients do when they fill out the form, we revisit it throughout, and we look at this like right shift of the boxes they ticked, and from severe down to not at all. And usually over the, you know, short periods or longer periods, we always see a left shift down to mild or not at all on many of the symptoms. But yeah, I mean, for an elite athlete, it would be different to, say, a pensioner who wants to improve their sleeping. We'd be looking at very strong breath holds, lactate threshold buffering, increased EPO, CO2 tolerance, creating calm under pressure, which is the big one for athletes, you know, when their mind goes, yes, their form goes, and
red mist, that kind of stuff as well, or helping them kind of see through the anger and frustration and use their breathing to calm themselves. Would you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So someone who might have a temper, who's getting booked all the time in soccer, for instance, or football, then yeah, we'd look at that for sure. It's not just a one size fits all. It's a big pitch that we look at. And I'm constantly finding things out of people as we progress through. So the longer programs are always beneficial to work with someone over a longer period. Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with you as well, because I feel like there's an element of trust that's built and people really get to know you as a coach. And they also might not feel comfortable opening up to you at the start, but as they trust you and see what you're doing and you're implementing is working, they then start to believe in you, and sometimes that's all you need. And then, you know, you find out a little bit more, which can then help you tailor it even better.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think that's important as a coach, as you know. It's kind of being super personable and really kind of making them comfortable. Mm. And most people do, you know, like with breath work, they have apprehensions about it because it's relatively new, and they don't believe that breathing can make them feel a lot better.
Yeah.
And they do start to see big differences very quickly, and then they become locked into it. And you know, obviously you get some clients that aren't compliant and they don't see the change and they wonder why.
Yeah.
But if you put a decent amount of work in, you'll see results very, very quickly. Yeah,
I'm a big fan of 80%, 80-20. If you can give 80%, you're going to get pretty good results pretty damn quickly. Yeah. How do you help people improve their CO2 tolerance and oxygen delivery? You know,
Again, it differs from person to person and depending on what, you know, who they are. But let's just say someone's got we look at something called the BOLT score, right? I don't know if you've heard of it.
I haven't, but I'm going to make a note.
Yeah, it was devised by Patrick McKeown of the Oxygen Advantage, and he took it from the Buteyko method, which I'm also a coach of. It looks at reducing your breathing to increase carbon dioxide. So that feeling of air hunger that you get when, say, you were diving into a swimming pool, you went to collect a brick off the bottom, and then you know when you need to come back up. And that feeling that you know, that is carbon dioxide rising in the lungs, which transfers into the blood. And the chemoreceptors in the body are responding to that. They're saying, wow, right, you need to start breathing now, or in a couple of minutes, you're going to be likely to be dead.
Yeah.
So the response is quite intense. It's that kind of like contracting of the throat. Mm. If you know where your diaphragm is, just behind your bottom two ribs, the diaphragm starts to contract and
twitch
and try and push down.
Yeah.
And open your airway. So it tries to open your mouth so you can take air in. So we would start with understanding what air hunger is, and letting them know that by increasing your tolerance to carbon dioxide and increasing amounts of air hunger during the day will improve your stress levels, will improve your energy, will improve your sleep, your recovery, your performance, all those things together. And it would look like some static exercises, very much like light, slow and deep breathing, down-regulating the nervous system, reducing stress and anxiety, for instance, and overwhelm. And then it would move into, when I felt that we're ready for that, depending on the health and fitness, we would move into stronger breath holds.
Okay.
And it would be an inhale, an exhale, and you would pinch your nose and you would walk, jog, run, sprint.
Really fascinating.
Yeah. And it gets quite advanced.
Yeah. Well, I have no doubt. I'm sure it's so much more than, you know, I'm sure we've only even just touched the surface.
Yeah, sure.
All right, Thomas, that is it. That's all we've got time for. But I just want to thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you? Do you have social media? Do you have a website? Can people find you online?
Yeah. find me on my website first. That's thebreathcoach.co.uk. And you can see all my programs on there and how to contact me. If you click on the inquire button, or contact or book a free consultation, that'll send you to a booking page where you can book a free consultation. No obligation at all. Mm-hmm. Just figure what you require and what your goals are. And then I mainly hang out on LinkedIn, a little bit on Instagram.
Okay.
But yeah, you find me at the Breath Coach UK on Instagram and Thomas Haig, my name. And that's Thomas Haige for my surname Haig. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. You have a great rest of your day, and I'll speak to you soon.
You too. You're very welcome.
Take care. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye. Right, guys, coming up after this short break, I'll be joined by Megan Jane Crabb.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction: send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
If you drink a little, then drive, you risk losing your license. You risk every day becoming more complicated.
How am I supposed to get to training, Dad? How am I supposed to...
You risk losing your job.
I'm going to have to let you go.
You risk your family not looking at you the same way.
I can't believe you did that.
You risk injuring someone.
Hello, I need an ambulance.
You risk being seen as a drink driver. Drink a little, risk a lot. Think.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, well, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you, and you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on Fubar Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Follow us at What The Health Show for more with George. This is What The Health.
And this is What The Health with me, George Bertineau, on Fubar Radio. Up next is Megan Jane Crabb, who is a best-selling author, speaker and digital creator known for her empowering work around body positivity, mental health and feminism. You also have over 1.3 million followers and you use your platform to challenge societal norms and inspire women to reclaim their fullest and unapologetic selves. Is that correct?
I think that pretty much sums it up. Yeah, it's quite wordy, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's great. I mean, I love it. You know, you're using your platform for a positive, empowering purpose. And there are lots of people out there who do not. So I'm a big fan of that. Okay. So first of all, let's dive just straight into the questions. How are you today, most importantly?
I'm as sane as a person can be when they have a book coming out in 2 days. So I'm okay. I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, that's great. I mean, super exciting about the book. So you've been using a powerful voice in the body positivity space for years now. What has led you to make this more personal route in your book, which is We Don't Make Ourselves Smaller Here?
So I've been a content creator for over 10 years now, and mainly known for body positivity. As you said, my first book, Body Positive Power, was all things body. I spoke about the diet industry, about fat phobia, my own experience of eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And after I put that book out and I'd done a lot of work accepting my body, I realized that there were still a lot of other places where I was making myself small, shrinking myself, and believing that I wasn't good enough and didn't deserve to exist as my whole self. So the next book had to be for me an exploration of what was next, what did I have to heal next. And I literally drew a map, and it started with body, and then it went to these other places. It went to relationships and sex and my life choices and my self-esteem. And I just explored, okay, where have I lost parts of myself? What could I possibly reclaim in order to embrace being my most authentic self in these places? And as I was writing, I was realizing, wow, these are such common experiences and feelings for women especially, but probably people of all genders, because we're all taught in one way or another that we are too much or not enough, should change ourselves to be worthy mm-hmm. of love or to be good enough. Mm-hmm. And that's the book. I just got it out.
Amazing. I absolutely love that. And already that feels very empowering to me. So obviously you mentioned in the book that, you know, there are many areas where women are taught to shrink themselves, right? Was there a particular chapter or theme that was hardest for you to write?
There were some challenges in all of them. The chapter that's called Hearts, which was me reflecting on my romantic relationships and where I had been shrinking myself and also been performing. I think a lot of women are kind of taught that the purpose of dating is to be impressive to a man, be chosen, you know, be saved. We get this fairy tale narrative of the prince will come and then everything will be perfect and your life will be complete. And so unlearning that, that idea that you need to be saved or that you need to be perfect and, you know, perform this flawless version of yourself in order to be worthy of love, that takes a lot of unlearning. And that was quite hard for me to look at dead in the eye and see the ways that maybe I was still doing that. And I'm in my first relationship with a woman now. I've historically only dated men. Okay. And it's a very different experience, and has taught me a lot about letting go of that performance.
Nice. Okay. And do you think this might be a little bit off topic, but obviously I'm a big believer of beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You know, I don't think a relationship is ever perfect. I always think it's about, so I've been saying this quite recently. I've been speaking to a few people about this. I don't believe in soulmates. I believe that you find someone that you're willing to make it work with. Okay. Mm. You're willing to not compromise yourself as whole, but the things that we are maybe, we can think of it like a sliding scale, right? We can move that a little bit and we can move that up a little bit. We don't have to hide who we truly are, but we can compromise in certain areas. But I think people maybe like yourself and myself who are guilty of giving a lot to a relationship and giving our full selves always compromise too much. So the sliding scale goes from instead of being in the middle and moving down a notch, it goes all the way to the wrong end, and then we lose ourselves and, you know, things like that. So
yeah, 100%. And I think that's where the conversation around boundaries and relationships, right, it can feel quite black and white. Like, you must meet every single one of my needs and be exactly this and exactly that. Otherwise, it's and it's not like that. You know, we have to compromise and we have to be willing to self-reflect and work on ourselves. But I will say that, you know, if you are genuinely not being yourself and feeling small in your relationship, that's a red flag.
Yeah, I think so. So you speak very openly about your personal experiences throughout the book. Was there a moment in the journey that felt like a real turning point in kind of reclaiming your power? So obviously you mentioned you're now dating a female for the first time. Is there maybe a potential turning point for you that's kind of helped you?
There were lots of, I guess,
light bulb moments.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I've had lots of those light bulb moments, and I had them in my journey with body image. You know, 10 years ago, I was really still into diet culture and chasing this idea of a perfect body. And I had a light bulb moment when I hit my goal weight that I expected would make everything perfect and I would instantly be happy. And I was like, oh, wow, I still hate myself and my body. Mm. So that was a light bulb moment for me there. And I've had so many since then. I wrote in the book about my mental health journey and struggling with anxiety and depression. And a few years ago, I got to a really, really difficult, dark place. And I started taking antidepressants for the first time in my life.
Okay.
And there was a moment about 6 weeks after I had started where I went for a walk by myself on the beach. And, you know, it had been months and months of just having a horrible internal voice and only saying bad things to myself and not allowing myself to feel any kind of joy or do anything for myself. Yeah. And I went for this walk. And the sun was setting and the beach was really quiet. It was the end of the summer. And I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to go for a swim. And I just stripped off down to my underwear and got in the water. And it was beautiful. And it was the first thing I had done for myself and my well-being, really, for a long time. And it was a massive light bulb and a turning point for me.
And it made you feel great, right?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. You know, not only just moving my body, getting those endorphins, but just doing something just because it's going to feel good, which we need to do.
We do. And exercise is medicine, but it doesn't have to be in the shape and form of going to the gym and lifting weights. I'm a coach.
Exactly.
And my biggest thing is I actually have like over 40% of my clients that don't step foot in the gym.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm a big gym goer and a big advocate for the gym, but I'm not here trying to turn people into Mr. and Mrs. Olympia. I'm just trying to help people build a better life, be real about things, teach them balance, understanding, and that comparison is the thief of all joy. And you're comparing yourself to someone that you want to be or you were, but you're a better version of that. And we're moving forwards in time and we're becoming better people. So
I love to hear that because my relationship with exercise has been all over the place. And, you know, when I was struggling with an eating disorder as a teenager, I was fully addicted to exercise and it was compulsive and and it was so unhealthy and so punishing. And it's taken such a long time to heal that and get to a place where movement is for joy.
Yes.
Movement is for my mental health and my physical health. And now I'm like, yeah, this is the best thing I can do for myself is go to a dance class or go for a jog or swim or cycle. And I love that there are professionals out there who have that actually healthy mindset.
Yeah, for me, it's all about just being that 1% better. I'm not trying to get everyone six packs and abs and stuff like that. If you're a 200 kilo person, but you want to be 120, I'll get you to 120. And everyone gets to a certain point and it's a weight and that image. But it's like, what do you want to feel like? It's not always what we look like. You know, I don't have a six pack. There are lots of coaches out there who aren't qualified, who are selling programs, are doing this rubbish, and they're trying to preach, because you could look like me. You will never look like your coach. You don't have the same physique and morphology. But anyway, we're going off on a tangent. So you've built a huge community online. How have your followers influenced you in the way that you wrote your book or your stories that you chose to share?
I think my followers have grown up with me. You know, it's been a decade.
Yeah.
I was 21 when I started talking about this. And, you know, my followers are majority women around my age. We've grown up. Some of us have, you know, started families and changed our life directions. And so I did want to think, you know, what do we need now? What are we thinking about now? And I wrote about, you know, whether I want to have children or following this traditional life path and whether that serves all of us or whether it's just one option of how to do life. And I did think, yeah, what do they want to hear? But ultimately I thought, what do I need to process? And what does a younger version of me want to hear? And hopefully there's alignment there.
Yeah, what would you have told your younger self? That's always the question, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
If you knew what you knew now or could have had been the richest person in the world, I would always go back to knowing what I know now but being a younger version. Uh-huh. Body positivity has obviously evolved so much over the years. How do you personally define it today?
This is a weird question because everyone will have a different definition of body mm-hmm. positivity. For me personally, it has always had two parts. Mm-hmm. It has the personal, which is your own personal body image, how you feel in your own skin.
Yeah.
And then there is the political, which is let's recognize that within our society, certain bodies are treated with more or less respect than others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are systemic issues here that we need to talk about. We are very fat phobic as a culture. We are still racist and ableist and ageist. Mm-hmm. And to me, having both of those parts and putting them together, that is real body positivity. It's not just about you personally. It is about changing the conversation societally and how we treat all bodies.
Yeah. Can we speak about toxic productivity? Why
we can, do you yeah. think
so many women equate their worth with how much they can do or achieve?
Well, I don't think that one is strictly women. I think that very much applies across the board, that at the moment we are all in this kind of endless hustle culture, get it done, be productive at all costs mentality. And there's lots of reasons for that, right? We're existing within late stage capitalism where every day we are taught to be on the grind, make that money, you know, no pain, no gain. This all these narratives that our worth is what we can produce or how much we can make or all these shiny achievements that we can then post about on Instagram. Mm-hmm. It is everywhere. It is everywhere. And unfortunately, to an extent, especially if we're freelancers, it can feel necessary because we have to exist within capitalism. We have to pay our rent and afford to eat. But I think for a lot of people, it's gone to another level where it's become quite obsessive and a real measure of genuinely their value. And, you know, I have friends who almost have a strange sense of pride in being burnt out. Like, look at me, look how hard I've worked. I've made myself ill because I've worked so hard. Isn't that amazing? And it's just so deeply unhealthy for all of us because we are not robots. And it's okay, like, for us to have human needs and to need to rest and be gentle with ourselves. And that's something that I still I'm kind of unlearning and trying to get a better balance with.
Yeah, I think work-life balance is really tricky at the moment, isn't it? And it's kind of like finding enjoyment from life. And I totally agree with you. It's like we're in this hustler mindset where it's about, oh, I can outwork you. But what do you have to show for it? Because my biggest thing is we will die in the ground one day. So just because you put in 20 more hours a week, but you lasted a little bit less time, was it potentially worth it? Or did you get to enjoy yourself along the way? But again, that's a topic for another day, I'm sure. So in a world of weight loss, injections and drugs and transformation content, which is everywhere online at the moment, how do you stay grounded in your message of self-acceptance?
Well, I think for me, you know, body positivity, it was not ever a trend. It was not just this viral moment that now we've moved on from it. It was a genuine shift in my values and my beliefs. And it was a promise to myself of I will not punish myself for how my body looks. I will heal my relationship with food. I will heal my relationship with exercise. And however my body then looks after that, I accept and I will work to claim and to love that. I think right now we are in a bit of a backslide. We are seeing a hell of a lot of thin is back in narratives and headlines. And I think what we need to hold on to is the fact that this was always going to happen. We had body positivity and its moment. We were always going to swing back the other way because that is how diet culture works. Yes. That are how beauty that's how beauty standards work. And if you look back 100 years, you know, every decade there's a new quote unquote perfect body that we're supposed to emulate, whether it was Marilyn Monroe or whether it was Twiggy or whether it was Kate Moss. You know, it's always happening. And right now we've gone back to the heroin chic era, and it's gonna change again. And you know what? It's not worth sacrificing your sanity to try and chase an unachievable standard that the majority of people cannot naturally or healthily achieve. And if you have to sacrifice your sanity, it's not worth it, and it's not healthy. So for me personally, I'm tapping out. I refuse to give my self-esteem away to any changing trend or any social media telling me how I should be. No, this is how I am, and it's more than good enough. And I have more important things to do with my life than mold my body into whatever changing standard comes next.
No, of course. And I think that's great. I want to bring up something that I've seen literally yesterday. There's a new article that has come out on GLP-1s, which is obviously weight loss injections, and there's actually something that says up to 66% of people regain the weight within a year of discontinuing GLP-1s because they aren't actually doing anything apart from just stabbing themselves with the weight loss injection and going, do your magic. And then when they stop taking it, oh, I'm hungry again, but I haven't learned anything about myself or my cravings or what I do. And then they just want to eat again. And that's so it's just unhealthy because then the weight fluctuation isn't good for us. What is one piece of cultural messaging that you think we urgently need to change as a society?
There are so many. I think what I would really like to get rid of is this idea that we can hate ourselves into a version of ourselves that we'll love. That if we are relentlessly harsh, horrible, cruel to ourselves, talking down on ourselves every day, that will miraculously make us perfect and lovable, and then we'll be so happy in ourselves. From experience, I do not believe that is the case. I think the only way to truly build a better relationship with ourselves is with gentleness and care and treating ourselves, you know, the way we would treat someone that we love. And then so much can be built from that. You know, I always, whenever body positivity and the question of health comes up, I often say, okay, but what do you take better care of? Something that you love and respect, or something that you hate and think is worthless? Surely if we have better relationships with ourselves and our bodies and actually think that we have value, then we can make sustainable, healthful changes if that is our goal. And that's something that I've personally seen in myself.
Yeah, sustainable lifelong changes. Yeah, absolutely love that. Right, final question. The title itself, We Don't Make Ourselves Smaller Here. What does the phrase mean to you now after writing the book?
I wanted the title to feel like an affirmation in itself, because sometimes you wake up in the morning, you don't want to go out into the world, you don't want to look at yourself in the mirror, you know, you feel like you're wrong and not enough or too much. And sometimes just saying to myself, no, cut it out. We don't make ourselves smaller here. It is giving permission to show up as your whole self, as you are, whether that is physical or emotional, mental, spiritual. It is just that affirmation, and is how I try to live my life these days, not making myself smaller and believing that that is enough.
Amazing. Well, honestly, Megan, thank you so much for your time. This has been amazing. Where can people find you online? Do you have a website? Where can they buy your book? Is it going to be anywhere in particular?
I am Megan Jane Crabb, and that is my name across the socials. So come on over. The book is out Thursday, and it is going to be in Waterstones or any online bookshop where you get your books.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time. You have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Good luck with the launch.
Cheers. Take care.
FUBAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay. on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose, and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I wanna find happiness, and I need him to be kind.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
Politics Uncensored.
The more alarming question is, what does this say to victims of these sorts of crimes which have been alleged on them? Essentially, what they'll be looking at is two men who have a huge online influence, who say some of the most disgusting things online and spout off some of the, I think, most dangerous sort of ideas and narratives in the online space, that they've essentially been able to travel to the US while they're still under investigation in multiple countries.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Are you aware of the tea alarm?
Tell me more.
Yeah, so it's this cultural phenomenon that we have in Britain. It's an alarm at 3 p.m. Where everybody in the UK has to have a cup of tea, and if you miss it by a certain number of minutes, you get fined, basically.
This ain't real. This is not real. I'm not playing into this. Yeah. You think me watching Keeping Up Appearances, you think Mrs. Bouquet was missing a 3 o'clock tea alarm? Y'all won't get me.
Follow us at What The Health Show for more with George. This is What The Health.
This is What The Health on FUBAR Radio with me, George Bertineau. Right, diving straight into some listener questions. Hi, I'm training for a marathon. What is the best recovery for legs after a long run? I find that the day after a big run, I am very stiff. So, first of all, I would suggest compression leggings. So, compression leggings are absolutely fantastic. They are clinically and scientifically proven to aid recovery by like 15 or 20%, I'm pretty sure. Maybe a little bit less, but still pretty damn amazing. I would suggest stretching and some mobility work. I would also suggest a massage if possible and if finances are available. And some sort of cold therapy. Heat is for growth, so if you are training for a competition, potentially use heat as long as you're okay with being, you know, a little bit more warm. But if you're stiff and you feel like you need more recovery and you need help with recovery, ice and cold is very good because it's going to help you feel fresher. Next question. What workouts would you recommend for someone who wants to get into weightlifting without causing injury? Plain and simple. Just start. If you're unsure or uncomfortable with what to do or how to do things, approach a PT or a gym floor instructor. I would also suggest using machines, because machines are closed chain, so you can't really go wrong. They normally only move in one direction. Very simple to do. For example, chest press can only go front or forwards and back. Okay, a leg press, you can only go up and down, or you can only push away your body and then bring your body closer towards you. So it's a closed chain exercise. You can't really go wrong. Start with lighter weights, start with more reps, get better at the exercise and the movement, and then you should be absolutely fine. How many times a week should I be working on recovery? I go to the gym 4 to 5 times a week, but should I be recovering more? What's your goal? Potentially, let's put it this way. Some of the best athletes train 4, 5, and 6 times a week. There's a reason why, because more isn't always better, but sometimes more is very important for load and getting you stronger and getting you better and getting you further ahead. Right, guys, that is it from me today. Just a massive thank you to Megan and Thomas for their conversations and interviews on the show. Reminder to you guys that you can download the app and listen each week and follow us on social media. We are What The Health Show on Instagram. Also, if you're looking for a little bit of help with your fitness and health goals and your journey, I provide a top-tier coaching service with no BS problem solving, and I'll also hold your hand every step of the way. If you're interested, please reach out to me at gb.fitness.health. As always, I'll be back next week at 11 a.m. for another jam-packed show. I'm Georges. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Love you. Bye.
Foo Bar Radio.